All right, everyone, it's the Grimlord here, and I got a question. Are you ready for some degeneracy? Because it's Grimm's Hentai Corner, and we've got Dead Igus. Yeah, a couple things happened. My whole channel got yeeted, so I'm at Grimm's Etchy Corner now. And I'll try to get as much of this up as I can, and of course, BitChute and MGTOW.TV are still going to have everything. BitChute is just a little slow, MGTOW.TV is up to date. So, be sure to check those out. Let's get started. Despite having met him here time and again, Minori Uzuka is overcome with loneliness. Supposedly, this was her parents' birthplace. Even after 3 years, though, Minori still can't get used to life here. Hearing people use unfamiliar words and figures of speech that she still hasn't learned only makes her feel lonelier. But suddenly, in this foreign, lonely place, a familiar sound reaches her ears and makes her look up. The sky is awash with twilight red. Some part of her mind compares it to her own hometown sky. The sky she grew up with could only ever have been seen through a screen or visor. That nostalgic memory of hers is one that is no longer humanity's domain. In fact, the last time she saw it was through a layer of glass. You're alive! Whoa, she's alive! She's alive! I found a survivor! Come on, get up! Silhouetted against a red sky, a strange person reached out to her. Huh? Hello? Can you stand? In that world where a spacesuit was necessary for life, this person instead wore what looked like a dress straight out of a fairy tale. Are you too afraid to move? Well, don't be. I'm a hero after all. How could Minori not be afraid? Both her home and the base were in ruins. She had hardly any oxygen left. Maybe this was all a dream. It had to be. After all, this strange person who stood before her lacked a spacesuit to shield her from this atmosphere that was too thin for humans. Why would she see this kind of dream, though? What are you saying? The first thing you should say is that you're there to save them. How can they take you seriously when the first thing you say is that you're some hero? I guess hero does suit you just fine, Lizette. Okay, you can have this then. That strange person that called herself a hero put something in her hand. If anything bad happens, just hold on to this and say, "Help me, hero." If you do, I'll come running to save you, no matter where you are. It was a pendant that looked cheap, even to Minori's childish eyes. Another sound pulls Minori out of her memories. She only notices it because of her training. It is the sound of flapping wings, not unlike the buzzing of insects. It heralds the approach of a swarm of large UEF propaganda drones. Large screens dangle from the dozen or so drones displaying a United Earth Forces propaganda video. The broadcast begins suddenly, hushing the tumult of the plaza. Today marks 9 years since the lunar orbit battle. Mankind must never forget our victory there. Although it was a great triumph, it required monumental sacrifice. We lost mankind's most prized jewel, our moon. And though we may have repelled them back then, the threat of the invaders still looms over us all. The UEF will not rest until mankind regains control of our solar system. The day of our triumph will soon dawn. Until then, lend the UEF your strength. Lend the UEF your aid. Citizens of Earth, the UEF needs you! The message played again, only this time in her parents' mother tongue. The crowd pays it no heed, only a few people looking up, mouthing a silent again before walking off. Normally, Minori would do the same. Today, however, is different. December 25th, 9 years ago, the moon that once lit up the night sky, mankind's greatest jewel, the Earth's oldest comrade and attendant. On that day, it became a raging battlefield. Breaking free of physical laws like gravity and inertia, a lone heroine cut down the CC and pushed away the moon. a Valkyrie clad in a white combat suit, flying unfettered and free. The one who called herself a hero, Lisette Augereau, the first special warfare trooper and the heroine who repelled the CC from Earth. The person Minori admires the most. If only she could be like her. She wants to protect people. Maybe not all of mankind, but even just one other person. That way, no one will have to suffer what she did. Do they really broadcast that advertisement that often? Minori jumps upon hearing a familiar voice whisper into her ear. It's the same as always. Mitsumi Bagenholm had apparently arrived at some point. I think they added some new footage, so it should be a bit more flashy than before. I don't know how much of that footage is real, though. With Mitsumi there to look at her now, Minori suddenly becomes oddly conscious of her appearance. She had boldly picked what felt like the right outfit at the time after a great deal of deliberation and wavering. But what if he doesn't like it? Maybe deciding to dress up like this all of a sudden might make him suspicious of her. Maybe he'll think she's the same as all the other girls who only cozy up to him because of his pedigree. No, he knows her. He knows she's better than that. But maybe he will think she's signaling that she wants to enter a relationship with him. That thought makes her even more self-conscious. It feels like he can see right through her choice of attire, down to the lacy unmentionables she chose to wear underneath it all. Still, this will be the last time, so maybe it's fine. Maybe, in the unlikely one in a million chance he feels that way, she will go along with it. After all, those who become special warfare troopers never come home alive. But though she might feel that way, he doesn't necessarily see her in that sort of light. She's worried he might mock her for dressing up like this. He might even hate her for it. No, things are different now. He doesn't see her that way anymore. He trusts her, if anything. That means if she realized she's courting him like this, he might hate her for it. To begin with, she's just not attractive. She doesn't know the subtleties of romance, and she can't hold a conversation to save her life. The truth is that up until very recently, Minori has never worried about what others thought of her body. After being orphaned, she had dedicated her life to pursuing Lisette's image. Every single effort she made was for that single purpose. All that mattered was that her body could serve as a skilled soldier. But when she became conscious of Mitsumi as a man, she started to question if her body was attracted to him. A face without any charm, stiff, slightly starchy hair, a short stature, thick, plump fingers, a waist lacking in curves with hip bones that were firm to the point of being masculine, flat buttocks that aren't so much as a hill, merely a continuation of her legs below. Man, she's really going to bat against herself here, folks. She'd seen dozens of girls around Mitsumi, all of who were pretty. Compared to them, she lacks a single aspect that would warrant a second glance. Realistically speaking, very few people fit the definition of beautiful. Although their faces can be seen everywhere in mass media, they are in fact the minority. But even compared to the rest of the military academy, Minori's looks are very average. On top of that, the girls who approach Mitsumi for his wealth are all fairly confident in their beauty. Of course their looks would be well above the norm. Despite her attempts to logically justify the situation, Minori can't help but feel inferior in the shadow of the beauty of those girls who stand beside him, as shallow and superficial as their beauty might be. An onlooker might think that her worries are a bit strange. Seeing Minori and Mitsumi standing side by side might make people raise questions as to why they're together, what with the differences in their personalities and backgrounds. It's not like they fail to make a good-looking couple, though. Now that Minori has convinced herself otherwise, though, she can only see her warped perspective of herself as the truth. Wow. Some might say that it's shallow to let the other sex judge you by your appearance. Minori herself has said as much in the past. Back then, though, she wasn't worried about impressing a man. Now she is, with Mitsumi as a clear candidate as her partner. She's terrified of making an overture, only to be heartbroken by the disappointment in his eyes. That's why she convinced herself that given how often they see each other, he doesn't regard her as a woman. They're merely good friends. She fervently tells herself that they aren't really seeing each other. They are together more often than not. That much is true. They've met up and spent time with each other more times than she can count. This is hardly the first time they've gone out to dinner together. It almost feels like they're dating. No, she's just deluding herself. And yet, why did she dress up like this? He probably picked up on how she feels, but has decided to stay silent about it. Oh, why does she have to be like this? Such unfamiliar worries are making her head spin. Her train of thought keeps becoming derailed. Minori! Where are we going today? The Barracuda, right? A UEF military academy spans the entirety of the Yoyogi region. Not far from it is an entertainment district known as Shinjuku. Within Shinjuku is an establishment known as the Barracuda that caters to the less affluent of the military cadets. Its dishes are cheap, large, and tasty, at least for the price point. It's an ideal place for young cadets to fill their growling stomachs. The two of them go there often, but it's hardly an ideal place for a Christmas outing, especially not with a romantic partner. So we're going there after all. She's filled with something akin to relief. If she could, she'd point at herself and laugh. It seems Mitsumi isn't interested in her after all. Are you so nervous about the selection test that you don't have an appetite? Huh? No, it's the other way around. If I'm alone, it's all I think about, so, I thought talking with someone I know might help me forget about it. The moment the words leave her mouth, Minori curses her own awkwardness. He had been the one to invite her, not the other way around. Why would she say that? Right, then you want to go somewhere else tonight? You know, to celebrate graduating from the academy. Just you and me. I don't have that kind of money. The Barracuda would do. But as soon as she says that, her heart wavers yet again. Maybe, possibly, by some chance, he might just have invited her. An impossible turn of events for sure. You see, actually, I have a reservation for two. It's only good for today. Mitsumi takes a piece of stationery out of his pocket. The name printed on it already sounds fancy by itself, to say nothing of the rest of the extravagant decoration and elaborate font. I can't go somewhere that expensive. Don't be shy. Some relative or another of mine is involved with the place. I got it for free. A family favor, you know? Mitsumi's family, another reason why Minori is so reluctant and timid. The Bogenholm Conglomerate. The Bogenholm University. The Bogenholm Foundation. The Bogenholm Memorial Research Institute. And so on and so on. Your family really does have a hand in everything. His family's name can be found as a prefix for all sorts of organizations and facilities. It controls a few others behind the scenes as well. In fact, almost the entire economy is underneath its umbrella. Or so it is said. Whoops. Oh, hold on. I wonder if that... Is that... Did I... Okay, hold on. Under most circumstances, Minori Izuka's life would never intersect with Mitsumi Bogenholm's. They only met because of the UEF's military academy. Although they were both at the top of their class, their pedigrees couldn't be more different. Mitsumi Bogenholm was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Although he had talents and skills suited to his station, something about him had always seemed shallow. Minori Izuka was born to an ordinary family before the CC took everything from her. Left orphaned and alone, she weathered her challenges through sheer force of will. She faced her struggles head-on, heedless of her humble beginnings. Mitsumi saw the war with the CC as a business opportunity and joined the UEF's military academy to gain the knowledge required to capitalize on it. Minori worked hard since high marks would exempt her from tuition, and because she wanted to walk the same path as her savior, Lizette. At first, the differences between Mitsumi and Minori caused them to clash and mock each other. The only things they had in common were their grades, and they competed with those at every turn. He was shrewd and well-mannered, frivolous at times, but ultimately a cold-hearted elitist at heart. By contrast, she was an overly serious orphan who threw herself into honing her talents. They couldn't and wouldn't ever get along. But spending their lives together in the same place, sharing experiences for an entire 3 years, managed to change their relationship. The turning point for that change was the winter of last year during a training exercise that had them hiking through the Northern Alps during a blizzard. Mitsumi fell down a cliff, injuring his leg and losing his gear. Minori was the one who found him. They spent the next 5 days stranded together while waiting for the blizzard to run its course. They clung to life, splitting one person's worth of rations. That experience formed the foundation of their current relationship. She had learned that his outwardly shallow and cold nature was the result of surviving his family's violent feuds. It is the mask he shows to those who try to take advantage of him. As for Mitsumi, he realized that Minori was a genuinely sincere person and eventually came to trust her. The two grew closer. They became friends, and then even more than that. Before she knew it, Minori found herself as the only woman by his side. And while neither of them had ever confessed their feelings, everyone around them simply assumed, or at least suspected, that they were romantically involved. However, Minori, would you rather go to the Barracuda after all? Huh? That's not it. I just don't think I'd fit in that kind of place. It isn't merely an excuse born from her timidness. Although she had chosen her clothes more seriously tonight for a reason, her appearance is still far too shabby for the word Mitsumi for the world Mitsumi lives in. As she spent more time with Mitsumi, she came to meet more and more of his relatives and colleagues. As one might expect of a family of celebrities, they hid their personal thoughts well, but the occasional glances of disdain and disgust they threw her way were clear. They crushed her underneath an icy weight like a thick, invisible wall of ice. The only person who never made Minori feel outright rejected was Mitsumi's uncle, a nice, cordial gentleman. If only they were all incompetent fools, she could feel better about herself. That way, she could write them off as useless idiots who merely thought they were better than her. Unfortunately, they have the talent and skills to match her inflated egos. Whenever she meets them, her heart curls up in fear. It feels as though she were standing naked within a cage of a zoo, with them sneering at her from the outside. Oh, don't worry. No one from my family should be there. I know where they'll all be today. A hint of joy tickles her heart. Mitsumi understands her plight. He realizes most of his family views her with contempt. He's looking out for her. How long of a walk is it? It's fine. I'll escort you there. He casually takes her hand in his. This is a first. She can't bring herself to refuse or shake him off. Compared to her clumsy fingers, his are slender and well-shaped. I want you to forget about everything today. Forget about tests and magical girls. Yeah. Minori nods meekly. There's no way she can possibly forget those things so easily, though. I know. If you flunk out, come work at my company. I'll be the president, and you can be my vice president. Mitsumi has been managing a company during his time as a cadet. It is part of his family's business ventures. I can't be your vice president. She can never tell if he's serious or just joking. The offer does make her happy, though. With such a life, she can stay together with him. It's an impossible dream, but no one can blame her for entertaining a fantasy, can they? You can do it, Minori. You're smart and decisive. Besides, I want to be able to trust those working directly underneath me. That way, I won't get stabbed in the back. Then just don't do things that'll make people want to betray you. That would be the smarter way to live. But unfortunately for me, it's a pipe dream for anyone born into my family. A pipe dream indeed, Minori thinks to herself. A future with Mitsumi. Should she be selected for the Special Warfare Trooper Corps, that future would crumble to dust. Even if she does scrub out, though, such a fate will never come to pass. Minori certainly isn't likely to ever betray Mitsumi. However, she knows she isn't nearly two-faced enough of a person to fit in with his family. In fact, she does feel a slight bit of anxiety toward Mitsumi. It might even be described as fear. Mitsumi is smart, sensitive, and attentive. He's so clever that it makes her anxious. Minori is too earnest to let herself charge ahead with only the blindness of love to spur her forward. So come what may, Minori has no intention of seeing him anymore after they graduate. She would like to keep seeing him, but she won't act on that desire herself. Today is the day of their last meeting. So right now, at least just for now, she wants the freedom to dream. As she lets Mitsumi lead her, the high rises of expensive hotels come into view. They sparkle and glitter like temples where dreams come true. I don't really get to walk around the western exit much. Well, most places around here are too expensive for a cadet. It's over there on the second floor of the basement. Mitsume points ahead to the tallest, newest, and fanciest hotel of the bunch. That's a hotel? Yeah, don't you... You don't want to come? Mitsume stops and turns to look at her, his features uncharacteristically nervous. Oh no, it's fine. She thinks she hears a sigh of relief escape his lips. Maybe she only imagined it, but still. Even if he were disappointed by her affections, Mitsume would be considerate enough to not let it show. So just for tonight, she has nothing to fear. But then, just then, she feels something vibrate in her pocket. It pulses in a unique rhythm she configured ahead of time. It means that just as she had hoped, she has been accepted into the Special Warfare Trooper Corps. She knows what she must do after receiving such a notification. She is to purge as much of her personal information as she can, pack as much of her luggage as the allowed weight limit will accommodate, and leave for a designated training facility as soon as possible. She has already made all the necessary preparations. Although her orders are to do it as soon as possible, the only real requirement is to arrive by tomorrow. She and Mitsume could, if she desired, spend this last night together. But, on the off chance they become a couple today, she'd long for more. She won't be able to restrain her feelings. In the event that she had misunderstood everything, and Mitsume didn't feel the same way about her, then she would only be unnecessarily burdening her heart with misery before throwing herself into the field of battle. She would be better off discarding all lingering regrets and attachments. They won't see each other again, after all. Minori casually shakes his hand off hers. She doesn't look back. She pushes her way through the crowd, running as if trying to flee from him. She runs and runs and runs. Once everything is far behind her, she takes out her now silent phone. Her final message to Mitsume is terse. I'm sorry. Goodbye. Take care. She looks up at the sky that is awash with twilight red. There floats the UEF's propaganda footage. In it, Lisette Agarwal races between the stars. I'm on my way. I'll be there with you soon. It has been about a month since that day. Having concluded her training as a Special Warfare Trooper Cadet, Minori Iizuka boards the transport to her new post, the Anti-CC Forward Operating Base, better known as the Cathedral. ...2099 AD, mankind embarks on a new age of exploration. Seeking to expand their sphere of existence, mankind forms city-sized bases on the Moon and Mars, going as far as granting the Moon the right to self-govern as an independent colony. Mankind expanded its sphere of influence as far as Saturn. Starting with Mars's orbit, corporations and nations competed for the right to build countless mines and sprawling industry. In total, millions of humans have spread among the stars. One fateful day, a manned craft was on its return trip after investigating the planet Uranus. Humanity was far from enjoying a universal peace. Even in space, armed conflict remained a grim reality of civilization. Yet everyone still believed the future of mankind was bright. That day, catastrophe struck. That man, Kraft, which had been on its way back from Uranus, suddenly disappeared without a trace. Other ships were sent to investigate the disappearance, only to go missing themselves. Finally, one ship managed to send a final transmission. It was mankind's first record of alien contact. Due to the aliens being similar in appearance to jellyfish and sea anemones, they were dubbed the Cosmic Snidarian? Is that what we're talking about? Snidarian? The Cosmic Snidarian? Or CC for short? As mankind struggled to rally itself in order to confront this new threat, resource outposts further away from Mars began to fall silent, in response to the appearance of an odd mass orbiting Mars itself. Mankind organized its first United Earth Forces fleet. However, this first fleet was utterly decimated by the CC in the aftermath of the battle. The hermetic barriers of Mars' cities were destroyed, leading to the annihilation of Mars' citizens save for a scant few scattered survivors. With Mars out of the way, the CC began their invasion in earnest, making their way to Earth. The survivors of the UEF military dug themselves in around the moon as the Earth's final line of defense. With conventional weaponry proving ineffective against the CC, the UEF were desperate. They used their remaining forces as bait, hoping to draw out the invaders so that they could be destroyed with an all-out nuclear barrage. While the strategy did lead to the destruction of most of the enemy's auxiliaries and escorts, it failed to inflict any damage on the large mass thought to be the CC mothership. Ultimately, the operation only served to throw away countless human lives. With the CC refusing to respond to communications through any channel, the destruction of mankind seems certain. At that moment, they appeared. The UEF deployed its last resort, the Special Warfare Trooper Corps, who would later come to be colloquially known as Magical Girls. Okay, Magical Girls and Tentacle Sea Monsters. This is not gonna end well. Tentacle Sea Creatures and Magical Girls. I see where this is going. Despite looking as though they jumped right out of the world of anime and manga, they daringly attacked the CC in the moon's orbit, stopping their invasion efforts then and there. One of their number single-handedly defeated the CC mothership along with countless amounts of their forces. She would become the greatest heroine in the history of humanity, Lisette Agarwal. She moved heaven and earth in the most literal and miraculous way, pushing the moon itself out of orbit to turn it into a missile aimed for the CC mothership. The resulting impact resulted in the extermination of all CC in the sector. The UEF suffered a staggering 95% casualty rate, but her actions snatched a victory for mankind from the jaws of defeat. The battle would be recorded in the annals of history as a lunar orbit battle. As humanity pushed back out into space, reclaiming their territory in the wake of the CC's invasion route, they were confronted with a bizarre sight. They found a strange spatial phenomenon reminiscent of an Antlian pit. Apparently, the CC would emerge from it from time to time. The Special Warfare Trooper Corps, entered that space to give pursuit. Within it was an unstable, winding, turbulent, tube-shaped dimension. The Special Warfare Trooper Corps with Lisette Agarwal leading the charge boldly pushed through it until they found its terminus. Upon emerging from that tube-like space, they discovered a star. A red giant that would later come to be known as Purgatorio. Orbiting around it was a single unusual planet, roughly the size of Earth's moon. From afar, its surface looked as though it were covered by a garden of blossoming vegetation akin to paradise. However, that was merely a nightmarish facade meant to fool the eyes of man. What was at first mistaken for a flower garden was found in truth to be an utterly repulsive entity. A mass of countless multicolored writhing tentacles. Here we go! This grotesque planet, which would later be dubbed Paradise Lost, was determined to be the CC's main stronghold. Humanity proceeded to sink all its resources and efforts into assuring that the CC would never launch a second invasion of Earth. There in the other dimension, mankind constructed a gigantic base known as the Cathedral. The Special Warfare Trooper Corps are now garrisoned there in order to keep vigilant watch over Paradise Lost. Now, in the year 2108, the battle between the Special Warfare Troopers and the CC would resume once more, with mankind's survival hanging in the balance. Last year, 75 subjects and 5 subjects were fined over a period of 1 year, 2 subjects were fined over a period of 2 years, and 1 subject were fined over a period of 3 years refused. That makes a total of 456 subjects and 34 subjects were fined over 1 year, 13 subjects were fined over 2 years, 4 subjects were fined over 3 years, and 1 subject were fined over 5 years refused. This year, the plan is to send in 203 new subjects. The quality of subjects seems to be increasing yearly. This year's yield seems promising. By the end, no, perhaps even halfway through this year. We can't be impatient, especially since we've come so far. We must not be impatient. No one must notice. All uncertainty factors must be eliminated. We must remain vigilant until the time is upon us. January 21st. The Lizette Augereau, a large transport vessel, carefully crosses the unstable dimension. It is bringing 203 Special Warfare Trooper cadets, 2 security officers, and 2 pilots. Gravity in this dimension is unstable, meaning its path is full of twists and turns. Even the width of the tube doesn't seem to remain constant. The dimension's official name is the RH. The name is inspired by Greek mythology, after the path that leads to the underworld, the road to Hades, RH. However, only official documentation uses that name. Colloquially, it is known as the tube. Sometimes, owing to its winding, bending, and unstable nature, it's even called the pasta tube. But as arduous the journey through the tube might have been, it will soon come to an end. Emerging near Anchor 1, they arrive at what is known as the Hades Sector. The Lizette Augereau has successfully crossed the pasta tube. 203 cadets, 1 security officer, and 1 pilot are all still asleep at the ship's main hold located in its central block. The Lizette Augereau is a UEF transport ship assigned to the route between the Cathedral and the Atlantic Station. Normally, it ferries military equipment and building materials, but this time its cargo is a large number of cadets. Cryogenic sleep pods were installed in its main hold for this purpose. Mankind has yet to perfect cryogenic sleep technology. The cadets' body temperatures are kept cool at roughly 50 degrees Fahrenheit, slowing the metabolism to a crawl while inducing a state of quasi-cold sleep. Upon entering the Hades sector, the awakening process begins. Chemical compounds are pumped into the pods to awaken the passengers. The ambient temperature outside the pods is brought back up to a comfortable level as the lights flicker to life. As the gigantic transport ship's cargo is awoken, the ship begins to decelerate so that it can safely dock with the cathedral. The bow of the ship ignites with massive flames as its reverse thrusters activate. This massive expenditure of energy is needed to offset the ship's current forward momentum. The Lizette Augereau continues to decelerate, and the distance the red giant Purgatorio burns ominously. The cathedral, fixed in place by the main anchor, eventually comes into view. Its official name is the Main Base Against the CC, or the MBAC for short. However, everyone simply calls it the Cathedral, the fruit of mankind's collective efforts to build a massive base. It is their first and only line of defense against the CC. This massive base central tower was built with the main anchor at its foundation. The central tower serves as an axle, with 6 rings connected to it by spokes. Within the central tower is the headquarters of the base's main force, the Special Warfare Trooper Corps. The surrounding rings serve as their quarters. The cathedral got its name because of how the central tower's shape resembles the steeples of a Gothic cathedral. The Lizette Augereau reaches the docking bay built into the central tower without incident. By the time it finishes docking, the cadets will finish waking up. The cathedral is visible through the forward observation window, where it grows larger and larger every second. Minori Uzuka is among these cadets. 1 minute later, the Lizette Augereau successfully docks for the cathedral. Thank you for coming all the way here, everyone. Please, follow me. Minori blinks as she looks at the female officer. For some reason, their guide strikes her as oddly familiar. She can't think of where she might have seen her before, though. Drifting weightlessly through the zero-gravity environment of the docking bay, she follows the officer's lead. I've finally gotten this far. Unable to suppress her surging emotions, Minori lets those words slip from her lips. After undergoing special warfare trooper training for the past 2 weeks, she is finally here. The heroine that shone in our hearts since she was a girl, Lizette Agarwal, Minori is finally in the same place as her, in the same position. She realizes too late that someone is snickering at her sudden outburst. Shame washes over her. A cadet should be cool and collected, but she let her childish excitement show. She quickly resumes her persona of a veteran officer as she moves with the group, right. A sealed capsule dangles from her neck, containing a small magical wand. Every cadet carries a similar item on her person. She clasps her fingers around hers, trying to calm herself. Each cadet's wand contains whatever key she requires to activate their special warfare gear. In Minori's case, that item is the pendant Lizette gave her so long ago. Calm down, you just got here. Nothing's even started yet. There's battles ahead of you. You can't start celebrating already. She finally feels herself relaxed as she takes a look around. She's surrounded by her fellow cadets. They all float weightlessly like a school of fish in the sea, lacking any sense of direction. A sudden realization shocks her. She realizes that the skirts of the special warfare trooper uniforms are so short they flip up all too easily when moving in zero gravity. The other uniforms worn by the UEF are generally standardized between men and women, with both genders wearing pants. Oddly, the special warfare troopers wear skirts. She dismissed her suspicions that they seemed awfully short before, but now, because of the similarity of the special warfare troopers to the magical girls found in anime and manga, rumor has it that their uniforms were intentionally designed to be reminiscent of those magical girls. Other rumors say the uniform's design is meant to compensate for the overwhelming casualty rate of the Corps. The logic behind those rumors is that having such a cute uniform increases the number of applicants. Ah. In truth, this uniform isn't meant to be worn outside of ceremonial occasions. They should be receiving their combat suits soon enough. A situation like this, where they're floating around in zero gravity while in the equivalent of dress uniforms, shouldn't be commonplace, so maybe the design isn't as problematic as she thinks, but still. Minori feels her face heat up with shame. Realizing she's just as exposed as the rest of them, she stands as upright as possible in hopes of concealing herself as best she can. Once they cross the spoke connecting the central tower to the rings, gravity once again pulls them down to the floor. This partial gravity is produced by the centrifugal force created by the ring's rotation. The cadets exit the spoke one by one, twirl in place to fix their bearings, and land on the ring's floor. Pardon. The sound of their shoes clicking against metal fills the room. This is a residential block. It was one of the base's first modules to be completed. Indeed, unlike the spokes, it is the feel of a place that has had people living in it for quite some time. Built over 8 years ago, it lacks any feeling of sterility, much in the same unique way an inhabited home does. Lizette herself must have been here at some point. She would have walked down those corridors with her idiosyncratic skip-like steps. Just the thought is enough to make Minori's heart tingle with excitement. You cadets would be living together in rooms of three. The many doors lining the hallway likely all lead to dormitories. Could it be possible that she'll share a room with Lizette? Or even just have the room right beside hers? Also, I have a bit of unfortunate news for you. All veteran members who've served 2 years or more, Lizette included, live in a separate block. You aren't permitted to go there for the time being. A light sense of disappointment washes over Minori. Quite a few of the other cadets seem to feel the same way as the sound of heaving sighs fills the air. Minori then scolds herself. She's not some kind of clingy fan who came to gawk at Lizette. Her thoughts might make it seem that way, but she's first and foremost a soldier. I'll escort you to the headquarters block, then. They pass through the spoke once again, exiting the ring and returning to the central tower. This is the operations room. It is the cathedral's core as a frontline base. The female officer points to the furthest seat from the screen. That right there is Commander Kinnison's seat. Although the chair is placed slightly higher in the room, it is otherwise no different than any of the other seats. Despite its humble appearance, the sight makes all the cadets, Minori included, let out a sigh of admiration. So that is where the renowned commander sits. Commander Kinnison, Rupert Kinnison. While Lizette Aguro is heroine of the battlefield, Commander Kinnison is also a hero in his own right. He is the brilliant man who founded the Special Warfare Trooper Corps. They know him as a man of action, the first to recognize the capabilities of Special Warfare Troopers. He personally convinced the leaders of the world to send him to the battlefield, even when that meant twisting their arms to do so in the middle of the lunar orbit battle. After that, he oversaw the establishment of the Special Warfare Trooper Corps and the construction of the cathedral. It was his transcendent leadership skills and political prowess that allowed him to accomplish those things. In his own way, he is just as much a hero as Lizette. They all know him as a man of steel who will pay any price and make any sacrifice necessary to exterminate the CC. Commander Kinnison is a capable, skilled commanding officer. I greatly respect him myself. However, she trails off. Minori and the other cadets wait for her to continue speaking. She looks around the cadets before continuing. All of the newly appointed officers here are women. There isn't a single man among you. Do you understand why that's the case? Commander Kinnison is a man. Everyone stationed in this operation room, aside from myself, is also a man. This might give you the impression that this base is run by men. But the primary duties of these other male officers is the upkeep and maintenance of the base, such as the removal of debris. They never leave the base's space sector. Their duties are very important in their own way, of course. Without them, this base would be incapable of doing battle. However, they suffer few casualties. Last year, there were none at all. That's why all the new recruits here are women. Remember that all the people taking command from this operation room would be useless in battle without women such as yourselves. In this place, you are the leading actresses, special warfare troopers, the women who use the special warfare gear. I want you to always remember that. We're the true stars of this show. We're the true stars of this show. That sentiment makes the cadets' hearts race. As much of a hero as Commander Kinnison is, they're the real heroines of this story. An elated mood spreads among the cadets. The female officer gives them all a satisfied smile. I'll show you to the deployment port next. Minori can hear whispering. Where does that explanation put her then? What do you mean? I mean, this officer lady, she's Cersei the dotard. She's no hero herself. Minori finally realizes why the female officer seems so familiar to her. She's Cersei Bernhard, or as some would call her, Cersei the dotard. Her old partner, Lizette, became a hero, but she just ended up losing the power to fight. Yet, despite that, she survived. Think she's jealous of us? Oh, I can totally see that. She has a way with words, but it's not like she's any different from the men. Yeah, there are people like that. She gets off on trash-talking people in the same position as her while clinging to her petty pride. Couldn't be me. Anyone with an interest in magical girls knows Cersei's name. She's a former Special Warfare Trooper who was part of Lizette's team during the Lunar Orbit Battle. And didn't she give up halfway through the Lunar Orbit Battle? Lizette should have teamed up with someone better. I hear they were a trio, but her two partners were forced to desert to survive. That's an urban legend. Fake news. Didn't their third member die? I heard she tried to run away, but failed. Didn't they execute people for desertion? Eh, I hope that's not true. I don't want to think one of Lizette's partners was a coward. See, I told you, it's all just an urban legend. I've seen footage of the three of them flying together, though. Yeah, fake footage. I mean, the third one deserted in the middle of battle, so they struck her off the records. Minori remembers the two other special warfare troopers were also present when Lizette saved her. So then one of them was Cersei, and the other one was the deserter? This isn't the first time Minori has tried to research what happened back then, but the name of Lizette's comrades aren't in the military records. Are memories incorrect about there being three people who rescued her? Well, either way, the part about Cersei the dotard being alive to this very day must be true. Isn't she ashamed of herself? I mean, with this kind of bad reputation, she has to stay in the army. What other choices does she have? Hearing the slander of Cersei strikes Minori as awfully unpleasant. As vague as Minori's memories from back then are, Cersei was still part of Lizette's team. She fought in battle and helped save Minori's life. Still, Minori can't help but pity Cersei. Despite being Lizette's partner, Cersei couldn't follow in her footsteps. All she can do is watch from the sidelines as her friend blossoms and flourishes. Minori tells herself that she won't meet such a fate. This is the deployment port. Here you'll transform into magical girls and deploy to do battle with the despicable CC. The cadets show mixed reactions at the use of the term magical girl, snickers, murmurs of confusion, sneers, excited muttering. I'm sorry, the way you deploy simply makes me think of magical girls. That's how Lizette always called them. Cersei's gaze becomes distant, as if she's lost in thought. Minori feels a pang of regret for how she pitied Cersei a moment ago. Cersei is still fighting the CC, just in her own way now. Surely she's also frustrated that she can't fight alongside them. Cersei then clears her throat. Commander Kinnison will explain exactly how you will fight as special warfare troopers once you've officially approved and assigned to your station. Once you're officially approved and assigned to your station, do look forward to it. They return to the ring, passing through the spoke once again. Also, the male officer's residential block is this way. It's the module between your residential block and the HQ block. I won't show you around that module. Casual sexual relations are not forbidden in this space, but they aren't encouraged either. If you wish to do so, you are free to pursue such relationships. For a brief moment, Minori sees something strange down the hall. Something light, a white, elongated serpent or a pale limb, twitching and spasming. A few of the cadets exchange glances. Perhaps they saw it too. But when Minori looks back at Cersei, the other woman doesn't seem to have noticed at all. But if you do, do keep in mind that it should not interfere with your duties as special warfare troopers. The strange noise and the white thing are gone. Did Minori just imagine it? This is the common space. An old military technology, it'd be called the PX. Special warfare troopers can order anything on the menu here for free. Just remember that managing health is part of your duty as special warfare troopers. If your bellies get too flabby, you might become too heavy to fly through space. A small wave of chuckles spreads among the cadets. This concludes the tour then. Your allocated room numbers should have already been sent to your portable terminals, so please go to your rooms for now. Your luggage should already be there. If anything is missing, be sure to report it. But if you tried to carry in any prohibited articles, including personal portable terminals, don't bother reporting that they're missing. If you do report it, well, you can imagine what'll happen. Cersei grins at them, but her smile doesn't extend to her eyes. I believe you'll receive an assembly notification soon, so do keep an eye on your terminals. I'll be seeing you later then. The portable terminals used by the civilian public are prohibited here. Instead, the cadets have been issued specialized terminals shaped like thin cards. These terminals are far simpler than the consumer models. They're incapable of calling each other, as they're meant solely for receiving orders. Minori checks her terminal, looking for her assigned room number. Room 14. And, as we enter the room, I think this is a good place to stop for now. So, we'll put this on Grimm's Ecchi Corner. Even though it's still Grimm's Hentai Corner, we're going by Ecchi. And, hope you guys will stay tuned, because I like this. I think this is pretty good. And, of course, Denkare, one of the, I didn't work with Denkare, but I did work with, what's the name of that damn band? If I wasn't half asleep, I would have remembered. But her other band, the Fairy Kingdom band, whatever they are. If I wasn't half asleep. Anyway, their publicist approached me after I did a review for a few of their records. So that was pretty fucking cool. I like that. And of course, I like Yui's voice. I always think she has a great voice for the pounding metal that they do in Denkare, which is great. I like to see a pounding metal song to introduce this kind of thing. It works. I love that kind of metal, you know? Always have. I've always liked metal in general, so it works for me. Anyway, guys, this is the Grim Lord, and I thank you for joining me on this special Dead Aegis preview. And please, please, please pick up the game at JastUSA.com or GOG.com. Yes, GOG has it. Yes, I know, right? So you can pick it up at either one. And the Gaiden version, or the Gaiden version, is free on Steam. I think it'll be on GOG soon. And, of course, JastUSA's website. And if you buy the game, you get the Gaiden version free. Gaiden, whatever. Anyway, this is the Grim Lord, and thank you so much. And I am out of here. Later.